Okay. Today, as usual, we're going to have a short quiz. On the homework today, I have most of it ready, except I would like to give you one problem that relates on the ATPase, the ATP coming in, being a random process, and then it leading to a Poisson process. I'm not quite finished because, in fact, I'm asking my theoretical physicist friends how to do the derivation, and they haven't quite finished it. So I think if I'm not done by this afternoon with it, I'll assign you the homework, and then you should check on the web before you do it as to see whether there's an additional homework problem. Okay. Today, after the quiz, we are going to talk about Fiona, and actually we'll talk about some science. We'll spend also a couple of minutes going over your questions from last time. Hopefully it won't take the entire class, but we'll see. So if you could get out a piece of paper and your name on it, and oh, there we go. Okay, have fun. Oh, has everybody turned in their homework? Just put it down. 1 minute. Seconds. Right. 10 seconds. 5 seconds. And turn in your papers, please. He can take them. Okay, a chemical process where there is a net gain of electrons is called reduction. A chemical process where there is a net loss of electrons. Oops. It's called a reduction. Chemical process where there is a net loss of electrons is called oxidation. These are two extremely important processes. Enzymes are catalysts. They often blank the free energy of a reaction by favoring a transition state. What's that? Lower. This is the fundamental idea of enzymes, and we'll get to it a little bit later in class, but you've been introduced to it. The nucleotide cofactor prominently featured as electron carriers are, this is a little bit harder. Good, NAD plus and NADPH plus. This is the constant at which an enzyme is operating at half its maximum speed. Anybody know? Km, or what is Km also called? Michaelis-Menten. Two people. Good. And the maximum number of catalytic cycles an enzyme can perform per unit time is called the no idea. It is called the turnover rate. We actually weren't sure whether this was asking a little bit of too detail. We'll see. In general, what I would do when I was reading, well, you read the whole thing, and then you go back and review. Go back and review basically in bold. There, in each section, there is basically, at the beginning, a one-sentence summary of the whole thing. So go back and review that. Go back and also review any bold letters. For example, this was actually in bold. Go back and review those. And those two things should make you ace it, okay? Okay, in terms of last time questions, it is sort of interesting. Everything was interesting. That's good. Very enthusiastic. I think I understand it all. Okay, that's one. Everything was okay. Okay, it's still good. Wait, hold on. Ah, still confused about today's lecture. Not so good. The whole mutation process is much more complicated than I imagined. And the video at the end, !!!!!! and then a happy sign. Getting now a little more serious. From the video, can they crash into each other? We don't know. Sometimes I feel like the biology-related questions should be answered individually so that we can understand biophysics faster. I don't know who wrote this, but if they would like to talk to me after class, I'd be very interested in knowing, because I don't actually understand. But if there's another way that we can get through things faster, sometimes I feel like the biology-related questions should be answered individually so that we can understand biophysics faster. In some senses, everything we deal with is biology-relating, because that's the idea behind biophysics, is to use physics to understand biology. So I'm not sure I understand, but I would be very interested. Okay. Question. Is there any other labeling method except cysteine methods? Because cysteines, mutations, like to form dimers. What happens is this is a cysteine. Of course, it's conjugated to other amino acids. But in fact, it can form a cross-link to another cysteine. And in fact, this is quite important in terms of making sure that the whole protein is folding properly. However, it can also happen that you go and you take out the cysteines, then you introduce one cysteine, and then in fact, one kinesin, for example, and another kinesin will find each other and will form this cross-link. And then you have cross-linked kinesins, and they're by and large dead. That's true. That is a problem. In general, what you do is the protein is at very low concentration, especially when you're doing single molecules. So this is not a particular problem. The other thing is you add reductants in your solution, which basically cleave them. So this really isn't that much of a problem. There are a few different methods besides introducing cysteines, but in general, they're a bit more complicated. Yes?
If you add, what is that, reduction,
adding in a reducing agent.
Reducing agent, but if you add reducing agent, how to add the labeling?
Okay. That's a very good point. You cannot add in the reducing agent in the presence of the label. So what you do is you isolate it. For example, you might add reducing agents to break this. Then you get rid of the reducing agents. Add your add your fluorescein, which has what's called a maleimide. Let it react with this, and then it can't react anymore.
So this reaction rate is very quick.
This reaction...
Delay, it seems like, as you said, you have to delay that reducing agent very quickly, and after that you add this.
That's right. This actually typically takes somewhere from a few minutes up to a half hour, something like that. So as long as you're at low enough concentrations, that's not a problem. Okay. One question. Somebody was a little confused upon was the final stage. Well, somewhere. Okay, we said we were going to introduce our, in this case, it's a single amino acid mutation, or we can do multiple, and then we get half of the plasmids have the mutation that we want and half don't. So I'm just going to review how we go and separate these. In that, remember, we have one plasmid per E. coli. So what we do is we take the E. coli such that it's very low amount, and we grow them on plates. You put here, and one here, and one here. And then, so you have one E. coli, which multiplies, and eventually you get a whole bunch of them over here. Then you get a whole bunch of them over here. But remember, they started with a single E. coli. So there's one plasmid over here, and another plasmid over here, and another plasmid over here. Then what you go, you take a little bit of it, and you get it sequenced. So you know whether this one has this plasmid or this plasmid. It can't have both. And eventually, you get it back, and you find, oh, okay, this one is the one that you care about. It's your mutated plasmid. Then you take this and you grow it up. That is, you know, you do a large scale of this, and then you have a large scale, and you have then eventually it's a lot of your protein is expressed. Yes?
Can we keep talking about these like one at a time, but are these done in concentrations of tens or hundreds at a time, or are they literally done one E. coli at a time, implanted and stuff like that?
No. It's done not only ten, but you know, thousands and millions of bacteria. But then ultimately, you dilute it, and you grow from starting from a single one. You grow up these colonies. Okay? Questions? Okay. Okay. So now we actually get to a little bit of physics, and last time mentioned this is Fiona, which is fluorescence imaging with 1 nanometer accuracy, and we can get 1.5 nanometer accuracy anywhere from 1 millisecond to 500 milliseconds. Okay, so this is the requirements of the technique. You need to have the specificity to look at the heads, and we've done this. We've done site-directed mutagenesis, taken out all the cysteines, put a cysteine over here, and then label it with a fluorophore. We need to be able to see it with nanometer spatial localization, which we'll get to exactly how we do that. We need to have something like on the order of second resolution, sometimes a little bit better, because in the cell or in vitro, the thing is moving along, and we have to make sure that we can capture it one step at a time. We, of course, need a single molecule sensitivity, because if you have a bunch of them moving at once, the in general will take steps at different times. And so you won't be able to recognize whether the thing is going at 0 and 16 and 0 and 16 or 8 nanometers at a time. Okay, lastly, we need single molecule photostability. That is, the molecule, in this case, it's a fluorescent molecule that we put on, it has to last long enough that it would show us a couple of steps, because you can imagine you hit it with some light, and after a certain period of time, the thing will, what's called photobleach, it'll self-destruct. And if it self-destructs within, let's say, a fraction of a second, that's not sufficient where it will allow you to see multiple steps. Okay. And the technique we use is fluorescence, which is really one of the few, though not the only, but one of the few techniques that is able to see at single molecule sensitivity, the ultimate sensitivity, and also fulfills all these other requirements. And of course, so the idea is you look here, and then you look here, and the distance between them will be the size of the steps stepping. Okay. Now, one of the things, it turns out that if you look at a fluorophore, you see the fluorophore, but you see a lot of background as well. The standard technique to get around that is called total internal reflection. And what it is you have, for example, a laser beam coming in here, and you have two different indices of refraction. Let's say this is glass, and this is water, where this is water and air, for example, and I'll show you on that. Depending on what the angle is, light will get through. But at other angles, the light doesn't get through. But what happens is there's an exponentially decaying field over here. And so anything up here will not get excited. But things within this exponential decaying field will get excited. And so, for example, if you put your molecular motors right here on the surface, it will get excited, where other things will not. Okay. And I have here one demonstration of it. Can somebody turn off the light? Okay. So you see, of course, at 90 degrees, can everybody see? At 90 degrees, it just goes through. At 20 degrees, it's a little bit bigger. It's more like 30 degrees. At 30 degrees, it comes and it's a little bit bigger. At 45 degrees. At 40 degrees, it's coming in at 80 degrees. And then eventually, Look at that. We're about at the limit, and you see the amount of reflected light gets through, has increased, and more there. Now 100% of the light is, what is this one called? Reflected, yes. And nothing is getting through. Except, in fact, that there is something getting through. It's an exponentially decaying field. Nothing is propagating, as in here. But when you're at about, it's called the critical angle, you're getting a little bit of TIR. That is, a little bit very close by will get excited. Okay. I think that's kind of neat. Okay, can I have the light? Okay. What decides where total internal reflection occurs? Yeah, the index of refraction, and what is that, the relationship? To get TIR, you want theta 2 to be what angle?
90
degrees. Okay, what's the relationship between N1, N2, theta 1, and theta 2? Does everyone agree with that? Okay. So theta 2 at the critical angle is equal to what? 90. So this guy is 1. So sine theta 1 is equal to N2 over N1. So what should N2 and N1 be? Which should be greater, for example? You know, this can't be greater than 1. Therefore, N1 must be greater than N2. Okay. So, for example, here we have water and air. So calculate for me what the index of what the critical angle is. So for water, n is about 1.33, and for air, n is about 1. So calculate what the TIR angle is. In fact, and then let's do it again. Let's go from glass to water, because that's in fact actually what you typically do. So then again, what is the TIR angle? And in fact, once you have that, what is the penetration depth? And the penetration depth I've given as lambda over 4 pi times N1 times sine theta sub I squared minus N2, all to the minus 1/2. Okay. So get together with one or two other people and tell me what that is. And in fact, we'll go and see via the demonstration how accurately you predicted it. Thank you.
decided to use here?
Good question.
Does the lambda score lambda?
What lambda do you think you use? 633 is a red laser, which is what the Heaney, and often that's quite a reasonable value. 532 nanometers is the green laser. 488 is kind of a blue. So you can pick whatever you want. 500 nanometers maybe is reasonable. Anybody have this? Raise your hand if you have what the GIR angle is. Okay. What is the GIR angle? What value did you get?
49 degrees.
Everybody agree? Let's see. Here it's 44 degrees and it's still getting through. And there. It's about, it's totally, totally reflecting, and it's in fact about 49 degrees. That's good. Okay, what about for glass and water? Who has it? Raise your hand. Okay, what'd you get?
62.46.
Everybody agree? Oh, okay, I had remembered it being 57 degrees. I assume it's... I wonder whether glass is 1.5. It is? Okay, well, then...
It depends.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we use essentially regular glass. Okay, whatever, 63 degrees, fine. And what is the penetration depth? Anybody get that? Raise your hand if you've gotten the penetration depth. Okay, that's right. How many people have it now? Okay. What do you get for penetration depth?
Like 1.1 microns.
1.1 microns. That, I'm sure, is too big. What else?
122 nanometers.
That's very close, but that seems too a little bit too big. What else?
I got 140 nanometers. About 72.
You got 72? The question is, why are people getting different amounts?
They could be using different wavelengths.
Yeah, what wavelength are you using?
I use 500.
Okay, what did you use?
633.
Wait, there is something wrong. Because, yeah. You assumed what? What? A 90 degree angle. So you assume that you're coming in like this?
Yeah,
that seems to be a little bit too much. Although yes, the angle, the amount of penetration is going to depend on the angle of which you come in. So something's a little funny because I got a penetration depth of 58 nanometers. Something's a bit off, but I can say that supposedly that's correct. I'll have to go and figure out exactly what I did. But okay, so it's on the order of 60 nanometers. So that's a very small distance. That's the 1 over E depth. So basically, any kinesins which are floating in solution, or any dyes that you didn't get rid of, or any dust, or any that sort of thing, will not contribute to your signal. Okay? Okay, so you can accept the sample and not much background. How do you do TIR? Okay, there's actually two different ways of doing TIR. One is you have your sample and you put your kinesin, myosin, dynein on the top surface, though pointing down, and you use a prism. And you make sure you get TIR, and then it's excited here, and then it fluoresces, and you collect it via your objective lens and then into your CCD. Okay. A second way is what is called objective TIR. And that what you do is you come in with the laser off of the dichroic. What's a dichroic? What's that? Anisotropic? Yes and no. It's a filter, essentially, that's at 45 degrees, and it reflects short wavelength, namely the laser. For example, the laser might be at 48 nanometers. It comes and excites via TIR. The sample fluoresces, and generally it fluoresces in all directions, but in particular, it fluoresces downward. This lens, the objective lens, focuses the light such that it comes back here, and it hits the dichroic, and it passes the long wavelength. And so it just goes down here and then is collected by your CCD. So it reflects short lambda, which is the exciting light, and transmits longer which is in general the fluorescent lights, light. And one thing is where the molecular motor is. In this case, you tend to put it upright because you have this sample here. And you're exciting this. There's an exponential decay, but this guy is all within the exponential decay, so it fluoresces, and the fluorescence is collected. This guy, remember, is sort of, it's on the top cover slip, but it's upside down. Does it make a difference that the kinesin or the molecular motor is walking upside down? Several people say no. Why not? Because it's really small. Okay. Many people consider me to be really small. If I'm underwater, if I'm standing up like this versus if I'm standing in my head, I certainly know the difference. Why doesn't the molecular motor know the difference?
I mean, when you think about it, in our cells, it doesn't just walk like with its head pointing towards our head, so gravity is essentially negligible on it. It has to be able to walk anywhere.
Right, good. Gravity is essentially negligible. Why is gravity negligible? Yeah.
It's all immersed in water, that is close.
It's immersed in water. The density is close. What does that mean?
It's close to water.
The density is close to water, yes.
So the gravitational force is balanced by a buoyancy force.
Okay. The gravitational force is but isn't that true for me? I mean,
for example, the contact angle forms that kind of other force much larger than this kind of gravity, that force. So it's totally neglectful.
You just do it because the blood rushes to your head.
The blood. Okay, so the blood rushes to my head. Go ahead. I don't understand. So, if I'm upside down, the blood will rush to my head. Right? That's true in water as well. Yeah? You assume so. Is that true? If I go in water and let's say I hold my breath and I go upside down, does blood rush to my head? I actually don't know. But
Do you know you're walking on your head or no?
Do I know if I'm walking on my head? Yeah. I don't know.
You can still feel the force of gravity, so you would feel your, unless you have a ridiculous sense of balance, you'd still be off balance if you're walking on your head underwater. You could still feel your feet being pulled downwards.
Okay, well, later on we will get to why it doesn't matter. But in fact, it does not matter at all when you're in water and when you're microscopic. When you're microscopic, it turns out the forces that you feel due to water are way, way, way greater than the force that you might feel due to gravity. And so it is completely irrelevant whether you're upside down or right side up or anything involved in your cells for anything microscopic. Okay. Okay, so this is now, you've seen it a few times. You take a picture. Here is the two-dimensional, and it's CCD. The color tells you the intensity, and you can plot this out in another way. You can plot versus X and versus Y and versus photon numbers. And here it is, and the width is on the order of 250 nanometers because it's the standard diffraction limit. The size of the particle is a few nanometers. But the width, once again, is like lambda over 2. But the center, in fact, can, yes?
So why were we talking about diffraction? Is there any aperture involved?
Why were we talking about numerical aperture? It's in fact the limiting aperture is over here, and it's defined by the objective. The objective for visible light typically is 1.4, which is practically 90 degrees. It's absolutely amazing. Again, for other situations, for very low wavelengths of light, they get much worse. But for visible microscopy, it's nearly perfect. Okay? So lambda over 2 times the numerical aperture is about 250 nanometers, but we can determine the center much more accurately than the width, and in fact, we can determine the center something like the width divided by the square root of the number of photons. In fact, next slide, we'll talk a little bit about what whether it really is the square root of the number of photons. Okay, so basically, with enough photons, you can determine the center infinitely well. So if you can determine the center infinitely well, for example, let's say a fluorescent fluorophore is on the rear foot, and then you take an image of it, you can know where it is to within a nanometer or less. Then it takes a step, you take another image, you can know where it is to a few nanometers, and therefore the difference, you can know whether it's 8 nanometers or 16 nanometers.
How do you measure the actin itself?
The actin. You have to nail it down. Do you remember we talked about biotin streptavidin before, that they have an unbelievably strong binding constant? So for example, let's say actin, and which molecular motor walks on actin? Myosin. What you do is, actually, you can buy actin that's called biotinylated, and you have your glass, and you put down some stripped Avidin right on the surface, and then, in fact, the actin. Let's say this one. And the actin is nailed down. And then you add your myosin, and the myosin will walk. And you do basically the same trick for microtubules. Okay? Now, the only thing about this is the photostability. The dye needs to last long enough that you can see multiple steps. It turns out that's one of the advances that the people in my lab actually made, where you can actually see this thing walk for a minute, let's say, which is very good. Okay. Now we're going to talk a little bit about the signal-to-noise a little bit. What does the signal-to-noise depend on? There are three factors, and in fact, in the past, some of you have mentioned it. So what are the three factors? Why does it depend on the wavelength?
Because it was determined the width first.
I'm sorry, say that again?
Because the wavelength determined the width, right?
And yes. Okay, yes. So I think four things. Yeah?
Thermal drift for Brownian motion.
Yeah, let's assume that Brownian motion is negligible, that we've nailed down the surface, and so it's negligible. Uh-huh.
And this depends on the brightness of the dye itself.
Okay, good. Depends on the brightness of the dye.
Well,
hold on. But so the brightness of the dye, how does that come in? Number of photons, because we said it was the width divided by the square root of the number of photons. Okay, go ahead.
And I think it also depends on how long you take the measurement, because usually for something like you do a particle counting, you want to increase the number of particles you count. Do
a longer integration time. Yeah, in general, there's a certain rate at which the photons are coming out, and you have to make sure that you count enough of them. Either you turn up the light a little bit, or you wait a little bit longer. But still, what counts is the number of photons. What else counts? Okay.
I think it also depends on how well you block the stray light.
Okay, let's assume that you block the stray light perfectly well. Yeah.
The CCD itself will still have some noise.
Good. The CCD itself will still have some noise, and that does count, I think. Okay. Okay, there's the noise, which in general is noise from other sources or noise from the detector, because these things are not perfect. They have some noise. It turns out that the noise of CCDs is incredibly low. They're practically perfect. So, in fact, that's not very significant. Okay. We've forgotten about an important thing. What about the pixel size of the detector? Why does that matter? Yeah.
It's too big here. It just gets smeared out, and everything essentially would be on the same pixel.
That's exactly right. So you have a spot. We said like 250 nanometers. If in fact it ends up shining on many CCD pixels, okay, then you can do it. But imagine, you know, imagine your CCD pixel was, you know, huge, in which case here it goes, and let's say it takes a step and it's still on the same pixel. So in that case, you're totally screwed. Okay. And it turns out that the uncertainty of where the center is depends on the width divided by the number of photons, this all is square root, the pixel size divided by the number of photons, and in fact the background noise divided by the number of photons. Yeah.
So this is without applying any type of fit or anything to it, right?
That's right.
Is there some type of fit you can apply to it so you can get even better?
Well, in fact, what we do is we do apply a fit. We, for example, you can do an Airy function, which is formally exactly what it looks like, and you can fit it. In fact, what we do most often is we do actually a Gaussian fit. It turns out that they're essentially the same.
So can't you get better resolution with that then? Because you know the exact center of your Gaussian?
Well, you can get, formally, you know the so-called exact center. But in fact, what happens is, there's a certain amount of noise in it. And the sources of the noise are the number of detected photons, also the pixel size, etc. So in fact, this tells you the limit. In fact, even with, you know, you doing a perfect fit, what the limit is.
Also, why does the CCD size matters? Because if you consider the whole system a sampling system, and if you satisfy Nyquist sampling, and that means you can perfectly reconstruct the initial image you want to receive at CCD, just do some technical tricks.
Yeah, well, okay, let's look again. The question is, why does the CCD matter?
I mean, if I consider the sampling system, and I know, for example, the thing you are going to receive is Airy disk, and it has own spectrum, and I sample this Airy disk according to Nyquist sampling criteria, and that means I can perfectly reconstruct this without any effect, artificial effect on the CCD.
Yes, but I guess in effect that the Nyquist theorem is not satisfied if the CCD is too big.
Yeah. But if I satisfy that, the CCD term shouldn't appear there.
Well, the question is when is the Nyquist theorem satisfied? And it's net. I'm not exactly sure, but it's never perfectly satisfied. The Nyquist theorem says, you know, like lambda over 2. But in fact, that that's just an arbitrary cutoff. So I don't think that matters. Yeah. I haven't responded so well. So let me think about it. Yeah.
Isn't the problem you just can't sample the area disk? The area disk is entirely contained on one pixel. You're really just seeing a single pixel illuminated. You're not getting any curve like this.
That's exactly right. Yeah, so here you basically get one number, and you're not getting a curve at all like that. Where if the pixel is very small, you actually get a curve that looks like this. Okay, let me keep going. And so now we actually want to test in reality what actually happens. So what we do is we take a piece of DNA and we attach a dye. In this case, it happens to be called CY3 to it. Attach it, a biotin to a streptavidin, then a streptavidin to another biotin-related complex. And what we're going to do is we're going to move the stage by a certain number of nanometers to make sure that we can actually see it. Okay, and in this case, we move it artificially 30 nanometers. And you can see over here, each point over here is our Gaussian curve fit. And you see that, in fact, we get 29.08 nanometers with an uncertainty of about 1.3 nanometers, which is just about perfect. And this is what the stage said, and this, 28.55, is actually what we get. So that's looking very, very good. And then what we do is we, instead of move this stage every 30 nanometers at a regular time, what we do is we program in the stage to move in a Poisson distributed fashion. And we do that in a Poisson distributed fashion is because when the molecular motor is actually walking, it will tend to walk in a Poisson distributed fashion. Just like that ATPase, you have a random ATP floating in solution, and then comes and binds, and then the kinesin or whatever takes another step. So sometimes that'll happen fast, and sometimes it'll happen slowly. Okay, we do this. We expect 28.55, and we actually get 28.5. The stage moves 28.52 nanometers, and we actually get 28.55 nanometers. Okay, so that says we can definitely do on the order of 30 nanometer steps. Then actually we do 12 nanometer steps, and we get very similar. And in fact, here we do 8 nanometer steps, or 7.6 and 6.42, and we get 6.52. So this says that we should be able to see, in the case of kinesin, the idea is to see 8 nanometers, or 0 and 16.6 nanometers, or for myosin 5, 37 nanometers versus 0 and 74. Yeah. Sure. Okay. So this is saying we have this stage. It sits here. Each of these is for 0.5 seconds. So at 1, 2, 3, looks like every 2, 4, 6, 8. Every 4 seconds, we move the stage. In case, 8 nanometers. Okay? This, what we do, is we do it in a Poisson distributed fashion. That is, sometimes we move it fast, sometimes we move it medium, and sometimes we move it very slowly. And that's exactly the pattern that you would expect for when the kinesin or the molecular motor is walking due to randomly ATP coming in and binding. Okay? Okay. So, what we're going to do is first we're going to do with myosin 5 and seeing if we can differentiate a uniform step of 37 nanometers or the hand over hand, which is 74 and then 0. What we're going to do is on myosin 5, there is 6 light chains, small proteins. What we've done is we've isolated this and we've attached a dye over here to a cysteine. We put it back on, and then if we put it on over here, it'll be 37 minus 2x, and then 37 plus 2x. Or over here, it'll be 74 nanometers, and then 0, and then 74 nanometers. Yeah. No, one at a time. One at a time. Okay, so basically, imagine one is on my foot, it moves 74, and then 0, and then 74. Or imagine one is, for example, you know, up here, and it moves 37 minus 2x. 37 plus 2x, and then a little bit. 37 plus 2x, 37 minus 2x. Okay. Okay? And so this is actually real data. It's taken at ATP is about 300 nanomolar, which is quite low in the cell. Typically, you'll have 5 millimolar. So nanomolar, 10 times would be 0.3 micromolar. That's micromolar. Okay. So this is an image. We use sufficient magnification that we go and we're recording it on several pixels at once, so the pixel size is not limited, the detector noise is not limited, and so essentially we just have that it's the width divided by the square root of number of photons. Okay, so again, this is 86 nanometers. What you're going to find is it's going to walk up like this, the actin you can't see. And there you go. It walks. It took a step. Took another step. In general, it's Poisson distributed. And you see how long this lasts. In fact, we're going to get kind of bored. So it's going. Just keep watching it because something important happens. And so, for example, can you tell me whether this is 74 nanometers or constant 37 nanometers? If it's constant, it's... Oh! Did you see it? You shouldn't have been looking at me. Because it was there, and then boom, it was off, and it was gone. That's indicative of a single molecule, of a single dye. Either it's, you know, pregnant or it's not pregnant. Either it's alive or it's not alive. So that tends to indicate, in fact, that it was a single one. Okay. And so, in fact, these are the traces. This is time versus position. And you can see, it looks over here, this is a little higher ATP, this is a little lower ATP, and the histogram is 74 nanometers. So quite clearly, it is a hand-over-hand mechanism and not an inchworm mechanism. And in fact, here is some of the traces with a guy labeled up here. And you can see it does 25 and then 57, then 23, and et cetera. Okay. Now, there is one, yes.
How did it vary so greatly or so much in brightness?
Good question. Why does it vary so much in brightness? Because when you're exciting it with the laser can fluctuate a little bit, but that doesn't really account for it. What happens is the dye blinks. In this case, we were taking it for 0.5 seconds. At a time less than that, the dye spontaneously shuts off and then comes back on and then shuts off and then comes back on. So in some cases, within the 0.5 seconds, it would spend a longer time shut off. There's an important point, is that at any point, 0.5 seconds, you get a certain number of photons. And that is basically determining what your resolution is at that time. And then 0.5 seconds, you take basically the width divided by the square root of the number of photons, and that is determining how well you know it. And that's all it is. Okay. And now, you all should know this, in that when we labeled a guy over here on the head, we got 0.74. And remember, we see 74 and then 0 and then 74. That is a convolution of two processes. And you guys have done all of this in that it tends to look like T e to the minus is the number of steps versus the time between the steps will look like T e to the minus kT. And in fact, it fits absolutely gorgeously. On the other hand, if you have a guy up here, in that case, you see every single step, and it looks just like e to the minus kT. Last one. So hopefully you all proved it and you feel comfortable with it. Okay? So in fact, what we could tell by this is that it was going on the 74 and then 0. And then 74, and then 0. So we could, in some senses, see that there was a 0 nanometer step. Okay. I guess we'll just briefly go over kinesin next time. Why don't we... And why don't we have our class evaluation? Next time, we'll go through this again is not breaking the diffraction limit of light. You're limited by the diffraction limit of light. Next time, we'll actually go through techniques which break the diffraction limit of light. And in fact, we'll spend several lectures on that because it's very fascinating. In fact, next time we'll talk about some of the work that I've done. The time after, we'll talk about what's called STED, which is a work by a guy named Stefan Hell in Germany. It's really tremendous.